Welcome to May 2023 with Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. This month, we are all about the coronation of King Charles III and, since it's May, Anne Boleyn. We have some of our favorite historians joining us, so sit back and enjoy. Welcome, everyone. I am beyond thrilled to be wearing my special Boleyn shirt and pearls and welcoming Natalie Gruniger, who is here to speak with us about one of our favorite historical characters, the wonderful Anne Boleyn. Here's a copy of her new book. And here's my Kindle copy of her new. Yes, I am a little obsessed. In fact, you can probably see all the tags. I thought about taking them out. And then I thought, oh, well, you might as well know. I'm just marking. It's almost every page. So thank you so much for being here. It is so kind. And I'm so excited to have you here with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so, so excited to be here and so kind of you to have my books displayed so beautifully there on your shelf.
Yes, yes. And one of the others. Not all, and I didn't want to flip back and forth in my Kindle, but here we also have In the Footsteps of the Six Wives with yes. Natalie and also the amazing Sarah Morris. So, absolutely. You know, you can just lose yourself in these books and it's so exciting. And so I just want to jump right in. One of the things that Natalie's agreed to do that I'm thrilled about is read to us. See, I love her words, her books, her voice. Read to us a little bit from the book to just draw us into that world. So if you could do that, thank you, Natalie.
Absolutely, I will. And I'm going to actually read from the book so I don't have anything very technical up here because I thought this is the nice old-fashioned way to do
yes,
it,
reading yes. from the book.
So I'm going to read, I thought I'd read the prologue because perfect. I think it's a good place to start and to get us into the mood and into the context of what we're going to be discussing. So it's not too long, so hopefully you'll enjoy this.
Oh, yes.
So on the morning of Friday, 19th of May, 1536, a large crowd of English men and women filed into the Tower of London to witness an event never before seen in the country, the execution of an anointed Queen of England. The star of this macabre show was Anne Boleyn, the woman King Henry VIII had ardently pursued for 7 years and turned his world upside down to marry. Anne had been tried by a jury of her peers and, despite her eloquent defence, found guilty of adultery, incest, and conspiring the king's death. Her five alleged lovers and co-conspirators, consisting of her younger brother, George, Viscount Rochford, Sir Henry Norris, the king's groom of the stool, Sir Francis Weston and Sir William Brereton, both gentlemen of the Privy Chamber, and the court musician Mark Smeaton, had been dispatched by an axeman in a public display of the king's supposed justice at nearby Tower Hill 2 days earlier. Anne's sentence, however, was to be carried out within the confines of the Tower, far from the prying eyes of any foreigners who might be touched by the plight of the fallen queen and spread favourable reports of her final moments across Europe. The onlookers, many of whom may have also witnessed the bloodbath on Tower Hill, gathered around a newly erected scaffold, draped in black, which stood on the north side of William the Conqueror's White Tower. Among the spectators were men Anne knew well, Thomas Audley, the Lord Chancellor, the 16-year-old Henry Fitzroy, the Duke of Richmond and Somerset, and the King's illegitimate son, and Charles Brandon, the Duke of Suffolk, who had known Anne since she was a child. Also present, the Lord Mayor and Aldermen of London, with the sheriffs and most of the King's council, including Thomas Cromwell, Henry's right-hand man, who within 2 months of Anne's fall succeeded her father as Lord Privy Seal, one of the highest ranking officers at court, and was raised to the peerage as Baron Cromwell. The impatient crowd did not have long to wait. At around 8 a.m., the Constable of the Tower, Sir William Kingston, followed by the ladies who had served Anne during her imprisonment, escorted the Queen from the Queen's lodgings, where she had been kept for the last 17 days, to her place of execution. The somber procession made its way past the Great Hall, where Anne had feasted in splendour on the eve of her coronation less than 3 years before, and more recently the setting of her and her brother's sensational trials. Under the Cole Harbour Gate and along the west side of the White Tower, to the open ground beyond, where the crowd caught its first glimpse of her. The Queen selected an English hood for the day's spectacle, as opposed to the French style that she so often favoured, and dressed with the utmost care, donning a grey damask gown edged with fur, over which she wore an ermine mantle. Adept at using clothing to promote her interests and emphasise her royal magnificence, Anne used her final public appearance to send a very clear message. In her eyes, she would die every inch the English queen. An executioner from Calais, renowned for his deftness with the sword, stood aside discreetly as following Tudor scaffold etiquette to a T and addressed the hushed crowd. She did not protest against the king or the unjust sentence. And this is a quote. "For according to the law and by the law, I am judged to die, and therefore I will speak nothing against it. I pray God save the king and send him long to reign over you, for a gentler nor a more merciful prince was there never. And to me, he was ever a good, a gentle, and a sovereign lord." Anne was well aware that any open criticism of the king or his laws would inevitably lead to more suffering for her parents and the fiery-haired toddler she was leaving behind. While she had not publicly protested her innocence, neither had she confessed to any great sin or admitted to having wronged the king in any way. It's what Anne failed to say that had the most impact, especially on a Tudor audience skilled at reading between the lines. Anne Boleyn subtly proclaimed her innocence and went to her death with the same courage she had shown in life. The queen was beheaded with just one stroke of the sword, and despite Cromwell's order to ban foreigners from the Tower, news travelled quickly around London and abroad that Anne Boleyn had died boldly. The speed with which these extraordinary events unfolded sent shockwaves through the Tudor court. It had been a mere 19 days since the first arrest, and in that brief period, six people, all but one prominent members of the king's inner circle, had been detained, tried, and beheaded, and their families and their loved ones left shell-shocked and bereft. The question, though, remained, how had it come to this? The answers lie in the 12 months that preceded Anne's downfall, a year that one eyewitness would later refer to as the Year of Marvels. So there's the prologue.
Oh, that is so wonderful. And as you say, such a powerful way to bring us in to the book and into that year. Because one of the things that's so exciting is this just focuses on that year leading up to her death. So you are an expert on all things Tudor. Your podcast is so wonderful. I'm sure everyone just loves it. What drew you to this particular topic this year, to spend so much time and so much energy just really diving into this year?
Oh, thank you so much for your kind words. That's very generous. I always consider myself a student, absolutely always a student, always learning, but thank you. I have been interested in the Tudors for quite some time now, and it's always been Anne Boleyn for me. It's an interesting thing. I love the whole period, but I feel most at home in her reign, and definitely most at home in, you know, the reign of Henry VIII, but where she's involved, absolutely. So it was when I was, you know, it's been sort of decades of studying and researching this period, and, you know, I had never actually blogged or written or done anything about Anne's fall. I just didn't feel that I was ready, even after, you know, 15 years of reading and studying. So there came a point where I thought, well, I think I need to dive in. I think I need to join this discussion. But what I really wanted to do was to look at these events within their social and their political context. Right. I felt that what we've had before, which are, you know, fantastic works that we've had previously, have always sort of focused on those last few months when they're trying to decipher what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, why did she have to die? And I think in order to get a really good understanding, and it's a very complex situation, but to have the best possible chance at trying to understand what they were thinking, what they were feeling, we need to broaden our view, and we need to look at the previous year, in particular 1535, but even, you know, parts and things going on in 1534 as well. and things start to make a little bit more sense. They're still completely shocking and brutal, but I think we do get a better understanding of what actually happened.
Well, I think that's great. And as you say, that month, just May, is just so stunning, but the answers don't really lie in May. And so even though we want to look at May and figure out what's going on, that's not where it started. It starts, I mean, different strands are going on all the time, but yes, things start a lot earlier. And so there are parts of 1535, and if you go back to 1534, but as 1535 is moving along, there are times, and you talk about in the book, there are times when Anne and Henry are happy and they're described as being merry together. And you know, some people think, well, once Elizabeth was born, it was all over and he set her aside. And that's not the case. So there were times things were still hopeful. So can you just tell us a little bit about the complicated nature of that, even into pretty far into 1535?
Yeah. How long do you have, Caroline?
I know. Let me try.
Let me see if I could do this without keeping all your wonderful listeners and viewers here all day. So I agree with you. I don't think the birth of Elizabeth was the end of this relationship. I think it certainly added to the complexity of it, but I don't think that's the end there. I think what it may have done is, though, planted a little tiny seed of doubt in Henry's mind that then continues to kind of grow throughout their relationship. But I suppose maybe just to think a little bit about the context of what's happening, because I think you kind of need that in order to understand why their relationship is so kind of up and down. It's been described by several historians as a relationship of sunshine and storms. And I think that does perfectly encapsulate what we have here. They were, they were a very interesting couple, and they had, you know, good days and bad days like most people do. But so 1534, there was a number of acts of parliament that were introduced that are very important. So one of them is the Act of Succession early on in 1534, which in fact formally recognizes Anne as queen. It forbids the king's subjects from appealing to, you know, a foreign power. It pronounces his children with Anne as the rightful heirs of the Tudor throne. So this is, and it also stipulates that Catherine of Aragon can only be now referred to as dowager and not queen, which of course she doesn't accept, and neither does her daughter Mary. So there's the Succession Act. There's also, of course, the act that makes Henry supreme head of the church in England. And there's another act that specifies the oath that's going to go with the Succession Act. And in order to ensure the stability of this new Succession Act, which obviously not everyone's happy with, there's a new Treason Act that's introduced. Now, this Treason Act, for the first time, words and spoken words and written words are now treasonous. So not everyone is happy with this either. And it's, of course, makes situations very dangerous where people can use this to their own benefit. So there's those sort of acts that are happening. But then in a more in the domestic sense, we have the end of 1534 and the start of 1535. There was excessive rainfall, even for England. So, you know, the crops failed. There was famine. There was inflation because of the failure of the crops. So people, the everyday sort of person in England is struggling. It's a very difficult time. Because of this new Treason Act, there's this sort of atmosphere of suspicion. People are accusing each other of having said things, treasonous words against the king and against Anne. No one really knows what they're supposed to be saying. There's all this, the question marks around how people are worshipping as well. So people are paranoid. They're scared. They're concerned they're going to do the wrong thing. There's also quite a real possibility of an invasion from the Catholic monarchs of Europe. Although I have to say at this point, Charles V is very much, his mind sort of taken with the great naval battle that he's currently fighting against the Ottoman Emperor. So he's kind of taken up with that. But still, I think there's a sense that this could happen, if France and Spain joined forces, you know, what would become of England? So there's all these things going on in the background. And so... It's a huge amount of pressure on this marriage,
Right.
In 1535, though, we do, as you say, we see some really wonderful moments. We see a renewed sense of intimacy. Unfortunately, in 1534, Anne, I think, has a stillbirth, a baby. Some people refer to it as a miscarriage, but it was very late on in the pregnancy. So this has caused a lot of stress as well on their relationship. That's in 1534. Her sister, Mary, has arrived at court very visibly pregnant, has not asked Anne's permission to marry the man that she's married. So she is sent away from court. So there's sort of family issues going on as well that are causing a lot of stress and pressure. And we go into 1535. It's quite obvious that Anne and Henry have lost the support of the French. This, of course, has to do with, you know, the emperor winning these great naval battles, and obviously France is getting a bit concerned with who he's going to align himself with. But she's quite clearly lost their support. The ambassadors are, you know, rude to her. They don't pay her the proper respect when they visit. So there's all those kinds of difficulties. They go on progress in the summer, which is a lovely time. I really enjoyed writing about this. They actually leave just a couple of days after the execution of Thomas More, which is kind of interesting.
Interesting.
Yes, when Europe is absolutely reeling and the Pope is reeling and, you know, and they kind of go off on this progress. I think they really needed an escape. I really do. I feel like the pressures were just so intense. And this is something, you know, royalty does every year pretty much. They leave London and they go and perambulate around the country. So the idea was to, they left Windsor on about the 8th of the 9th of July, and the plan was to travel around for 3 months, go through the West Country to Bristol, and then sort of circle back and come back to Windsor. In the end, this progress takes 4 months, so they actually extend it for a month, which I think shows that they are having a wonderful time and they don't want to return to, you know, they don't want to come back to the reality.
Real life, yeah.
Oh, gosh. And you know how it feels when you go on holiday and you come back and you've got all those pressures and work stuff waiting for you. So what we see during this time is that they're doing those things that connected them in the first place. So they're hunting, they're hawking, they're listening to musicians, they're spending time with their favorite people. You know, they're outdoors a lot. We have such fantastic records of them arriving back after a day out, you know, riding and hunting, and they're arriving back and being walked to their chambers by torchlight because they're coming back so late, you know. And if you've been to England in the summer, you know, it doesn't get dark until like 10 p.m. or something. So they are literally out the whole day doing what they love. They're with their favorites. They're visiting people that supported the marriage. They are visiting people that are more reform-minded as well. There's just, it's all those things that connected them. And of course we see, I think, the ultimate evidence of this renewed intimacy and companionship between them is that Anne falls pregnant towards the end of this particular progress. So it is, it's a really wonderful time. And as you said, there are so many reports of them being merry together, and they don't end up in Bristol in the end because there's plague there. So the second sort of half of this progress is altered because they're trying to avoid plague in Farnham and plague in Bristol. And so they kind of make some changes, but they definitely stay longer than they should have.
Well, and that's a really interesting way to think about them in, as we're getting into later 1535, when, you know, it might think, in looking back from what we know happens, that things would have been falling drastically apart, but they're not. So there's a lot of hope maybe for them. And there seems to be, you know, a new chance and a new pregnancy and a new opportunity. So then they do return to real life where the problems have awaited them. So how, but still the Christmas and New Year celebrations still seem to be positive in terms of the reports, right? I mean, still through the Christmas and the holiday, you know, the full 12 days of Christmas as they celebrate it, the reports still look positive. Like there's still a better sense of the two of them being together.
Yes, I think you're right. Absolutely. I think because Anne was pregnant, there's this hope that she's pregnant with the heir. You know, that's certainly what Anne wanted to believe. That's certainly what Henry wanted to believe. That's certainly what people were hoping for. And so I think there is this kind of joyous sense. You know, it's difficult with Henry because, as I've said, I think many times in the book, he is a brilliant performer and he puts on facades when he needs to. So I feel like I think there would have still been, you know, things going on in his mind where he's questioning all these troubles that he has, all these political problems that he has, and they all pretty much stem from his marriage to Anne. And at some point he must have said that to himself, whether it be in a quiet moment, whether he said it to another courtier, one of his favorites. at some point he must have acknowledged that all the stuff that's going on that's causing him stress would not have happened had he not married Anne, but he's never going to admit that publicly, never, ever.
You know? No, and he's certainly never going to think any of it was his fault. So,
Never.
No. So if there is someone at fault, it's someone else in the room.
It's someone else. Yeah.
So then we get into January and things really shift. And so I wanted to talk just a little bit about, because one of the first events in January is the death of Catherine of Aragon and Henry and Anne's response to that, which I've seen written about and portrayed in many different ways with the wearing of yellow or the wearing of mourning and why yellow and well, yellow is mourning or whatever. So can you sort of bring us up to speed on that? Because you see it all kinds of different ways.
Of course, of course. And I actually looked into this many years ago when I sort of, when those theories were sort of coming out. Mm-hmm. So it has been something I've looked at many times. So I'm quite confident in what I'm telling you, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Right.
So we have two sources for that event. So yes, Catherine of Aragon dies. News arrives. Probably Henry and Anne are probably at Greenwich when they hear the news that Catherine has died. So we have two sources for the event that you're talking about, and that is Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador who has eyes everywhere, and Edward Hall, the Tudor chronicler that, you know, we often use in when we're studying Tudor history. So Chapuis comments, he's writing a letter and he gives details of what his informer has told him. And that is that and I'll read you this quote because I've actually got it here, Carolyn. The king was clad all over in yellow from top to toe, except for the feather he had in his bonnet. And then he goes on to say that there were great demonstrations of joy at court. So you can notice there, Chapuis does not mention Anne when it comes to the color of what her clothing is. He later does say that she was also kind of very happy at the news and that she handsomely rewarded the messenger. So then the other source that speaks about this is Edward Hall. And all he says is, yes, that Henry was in yellow, but he adds Queen Anne wore yellow for the mourning. So mourning. So this is what's caused the confusion. This is why some people have hypothesized that, oh, mourning. Oh, okay, that's the color. Yellow is the color of mourning in Spain.
Right.
Which is not. I've done quite thorough research and I've not found anyone that can sort of substantiate that with any evidence. So I don't think that's got anything to do with it. So I wonder, Chapuis, who of course loved to kind of, you know, share information of when Anne's doing naughty things.
Right.
He would have loved to have said that she was wearing yellow. He doesn't. Edward Hall does. So we're left with that sort of conundrum. I think that there was a brief moment that, yes, they would have been happy because finally, and I think if we're talking about Anne from Anne's perspective, she's now the only queen left in England. Right. And for a moment, I think that must have been like, oh, what a relief. Thankfully, you know what I mean? It's just a normal human response to all these years of being, you know, the two sort of queens. And Henry, of course, is reported as being really happy because now he thinks he's got one up on the French. He thinks now because Catherine's gone, he's going to be able to deal with the Spanish more, you know, in a better way. And that means he's going to have more leverage with the French to do whatever he wants with them. So he's kind of ecstatic for that reason. And Anne is happy, I think, in some way kind of happy because she's the only queen for the first time in her, you know, whole reign. So, just those two sources in there. And we, you know, we can't say for certain that Anne was also dressed in yellow. Perhaps she was, perhaps she wasn't. It does appear there was, you know, there were celebrations. Henry had Elizabeth with him and sort of paraded her around.
Yes.
You know, and they went dancing with the women. And then when he was tired of that, he went jousting to the tilt yard.
Right. And that certainly sounds that's an interesting way to look at it, that they do seem happy. And you mentioned Chapuis, who is such a fascinating source because it's in his best interest to certainly write the truth in his reports. They're certainly not friendly toward Anne, but it's unlikely he would just make things completely up. I mean, they are counting on him. The foreign courts are counting on him to report the truth, as slanted against Anne as it might be. So you're right. He would have loved to say she was in yellow if his sources had said so, or that she was the only one in yellow and she was out of touch or whatever. So Catherine's death also, though, opens up the opportunity for Henry to set Anne aside without needing to take Catherine back, right? So that's sort of been, and Anne, I don't think, thinks in those ways. And probably we wouldn't either if things hadn't turned out the way they did. I mean, a lot of our thinking about it, of course, comes knowing the end. But it also opens a door, which I don't think they really knew at the time. So you mentioned Henry, after dancing for a while, goes off to the tilt yard because that is his great passion. And that is the next thing that happens that month that really changes things, yeah, is this jousting accident. And for him, it's more than just like a sports injury. For him, it is life changing. And how did that play out? And do you think he realized how serious the accident was? Because at the moment, Elizabeth's his only heir, and he doesn't think that's a real heir, right? That's not a real solution. So talk to us a little bit about that accident and how serious it was and how important it was to him.
Yes, this is such a fascinating thing. I this is just a topic that I think we could discuss for quite a long time, because it's, I don't think it's been given that the focus really, or we've seen the far-reaching effects that it had, you know, up until sort of recently. So 24th of January, this is a big month. January 1536, there's just a lot going on at court. You know, we've already had the death of Catherine of Aragon, and now 24th of January, Henry is, he, by all, it seems what the evidence seems to point to, and I need to also mention Emma Levitt, the work of Emma Levitt, if anyone wants to go into this in more detail. She's done some great things around this, just this idea of jousting jealousy.
Yeah, I love that.
So according to her research, and she's gone through all the records, there was no tournament at Greenwich in January 1536, so no official tournament, which means it's more than likely that Henry was training when this accident occurred. So this is important for a number of reasons. So he's training, which means that would explain why Anne is not there watching, because the news gets brought to her. So that kind of explains that, because otherwise it's strange. Why was she
It's strange that she wouldn't be there, yeah.
So, you know, he's training. And this, so Henry is just so preoccupied with this idea of honor and his masculinity. And this is one way, when he's not off at war, because he's not often going to war, is he? You know, this is a way that he can display his vigor and prove his sort of manhood and his masculinity in a public arena, is on the jousting, you know, the jousting tilt yard. So he spends a lot of time training for these things, and he's been doing it since he was a child. And he's, you know, generally thought to have been quite good at it, I think.
Right. Very athletic early on.
Yeah. Very athletic. He does all the faults, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. So he loves it as well. This is so inextricably linked with his identity as a king. It's almost impossible to kind of separate these two things, you know. So he's out there training, and Emma Levitt suggests he's in fact training for the May Day joust, which is in itself very interesting.
Oh,
so that's the joust that occurs on the 1st of May, 1536.
Okay.
So he's training with his training companions, he's the men of the Privy Chamber, he's probably got some servants around, and he is, there's also several sources for this particular event, one of which is Chapuis, again, of course, Imperial Ambassador. There's Charles V's ambassador in Rome, Dr. Ortiz, and there is one more, Charles Risley as well.
Okay.
Who sort of report on this particular event. And we hear slightly contradictory things, as usual, with the Tudors, as always. Nothing's ever sort of clear-cut. So Henry is training. We hear from Risley. He's doing a training exercise that he's done a million times before. He's basically, it's training for accuracy. So Henry is running, the horse is galloping by the tilt yard barrier at full speed, and Henry is attempting to poke his lance into a little ring, and it's just to get, you know, accuracy going. And what happens is he falls during one of these incidents, and the horse topples on top of him. Now, the fact that he wasn't in a proper tournament probably saved his life, because it's unlikely that the horse would have been armored. So if you can imagine during an actual proper tilt, the horse would have been armored, would have weighed, oh goodness, I don't even know how much, fall on top of Henry, he probably would have been killed or very seriously injured. The fact that the horse was unlikely to have been armored probably saved his life. However, the injury to his ego was huge. He has fallen not in some noble, you know, not against another nobleman. He's just literally had an accident, you know.
Fallen off, yeah.
He's just fallen off in front of all these men that are very skilled jousters. And they just so happen to be men like George Boleyn, Henry Norris, William Brereton, Francis Weston, possibly Mark Smeaton if he was there, you know, in an entertainment capacity. So, you know, you have to start sort of putting
that is together. So interesting. I had heard those men linked with Wolsey and therefore Cromwell, and Cromwell had his eye on them. But it was so interesting for me to think about if they saw him fall in that way, and then they're all still athletes. They're all still jousting in me. So,
Absolutely. And we have to, I can't really stress enough that this was the end of Henry's jousting career. He never jousted again. So the impact of this on a man who, you know, firstly, he loves it. It's a sport that he absolutely loves. It's kept him fit, you know, fairly fit up until this point. There's disagreement on what sort of injuries were caused, but he is up and, you know, up and back in action pretty quickly. So it doesn't seem that anything physical major occurred. It may have reopened some ulcers, some old wounds that he had and went on to cause him a great deal of trouble from sort of this moment on. But the most important thing, I think, is that he was no longer able to display his masculinity in this way, yet all the other men around him were. And if you, I think sometimes we forget about the ages of the men. So Henry Norris was in his mid-50s. He was older than the king by a number. And he's still out there jousting. William Brereton was also around the same age as the king. So they weren't, you know, that Smeaton and Weston were in their 20s and George Boleyn early 30s. But Norris and Brereton were older than Henry and they were still out there doing what they love. Thomas Boleyn, you know. So this caused a lot of issues for Henry, definitely.
And it is this moment where that was so important to him. That was such a part of his identity and the way he celebrated and the way he presented himself. The Tudors were so focused on how they presented themselves as these great monarchs. And this was a big way for Henry to present himself. So for that to be ripped away from him in this dramatic, public, embarrassing way.
And it's also, as you said, it was another reminder of his mortality and the fact that he's only got Elizabeth, which, of course, we know what she went on to become.
But
for him, this was just not even a thought that he was going to accept that she could rule in her own right. You know, so I think, again, those that little seed that had been kind of germinating throughout really does sprout big time at this point, you know, where he's concerned about all these things and he's embarrassed. And really, Henry, an injured Henry, is the most dangerous of all. So
yes, it's like when you corner an animal that's that you just never know what they're going to do. And this focus on also he hasn't had a son and his counterparts slash competitors in Europe, like Francis I and Charles V, are having sons. And so he so desperately wants to show his power and his manliness in this way that they are. And he can't. First, because not having a son, and now he can't joust anymore. So this must have been just a really important changing moment for him.
Yes, I really do think this shifts the story and the trajectory of the story. And we see him become increasingly jealous of those other men, men that, of course, also surround Anne. You know, one of them's her own brother, but the other men that have been, that are often, you know, the men from the Privy Chamber interacted with the women of Anne's household. That was very common, and that was done in all kind of reigns. However, now it takes on this more sort of sinister tone, I suppose you could say.
Right, because of his way of looking at them has changed. And then in the worst timing possible, that hope for a son to, you know, had there been a healthy baby boy, living with the jousting might have been easier. But he also, in just a few days, loses that possibility with Anne as she has another stillbirth. And in this case, according to the reports, she was far enough along to know it was a boy. Does that seem, I mean, I hear that a lot. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah, it's such a heart-wrenching event, and it was very difficult to write about and to research. But I did want to know if that was a possibility. And yes, after speaking to a number of of women. I think that is correct. Absolutely okay. correct. That she would have been able to tell if, you know, because I think there are varying accounts again, but she was probably around 4 months, you know, along in her pregnancy, about 14 to 16 weeks or something like that. So, and it does appear that, yes, you know, you can tell the sex of the baby.
All right. So the two of them have this loss, but this does seem to be the beginning of a more deep fracture between them because they don't come together with the loss. So we had seen them coming together in 1535 and on the progress and maybe even through the holidays. But at this point, probably as Henry is still recovering, at least mentally, emotionally yeah. from the jousting, then the loss of this child was just devastating to him and to Anne. So what kind of, what level of finality or how significant is that as this sort of propels into the next few months?
Yes, it's always so difficult to assess because, like I say, Henry puts up this facade. He does
right.
for the moment. There are accounts of him kind of lashing out at her and saying that he sees that God will not grant her any sons with Anne. You know, and we have accounts of Anne being so incredibly courageous and just strong. And instead of, you know, going into this world of grief that I imagine she was feeling, she's consoling her ladies that are devastated for her. Because they are right. they are loyal to Anne by now. They've been with her for a long time.
Yes.
And they've seen the heartache that she's endured. And I think that has brought them all quite close together. And so the reports we have is of her consoling her ladies and saying, it's okay, you know, we can try again type thing. But Henry is of another mind and he's kind of saying, no, well, he thinks that this is God's way of telling him that he's again, you know, mm-hmm. made a mistake, basically, although he's not admitting it in those terms. So they not do have a time where they're separated. Henry goes off to do, you know, business of state and whatnot. Anne's left behind. But then the facade sort of resumes and everything looks okay, you know, in sort of March and still being granted right. various things. He's still trying to get her recognized as queen. But I don't yes. think we should read too much into this in terms of Henry's love for Anne or his commitment to stay with her. I think this is just how Henry operates. You know, the performer in him, the facade that he puts up. We do, of course, though, in February get the first mention of Jane Seymour. So, you know, we, right. we see what's happening. The king is feeling inadequate. So he has gone off, you know, to find someone to try and make him feel a little bit better because he's not finding that with Anne anymore. So right. it is a very confusing kind of, there's a lot of turmoil going on and it is difficult to assess what people are feeling. But I think he definitely, my opinion is that had that son lived, had it been born, and mm-hmm. would have been safe at least for the meantime. Mm-hmm. I don't think he would have executed her had she given birth to a healthy son. I think he would have revered her, in fact, to be honest with you. But it doesn't work out that way, obviously. So I think he did close his heart to her at that point. I think, you know, as I explain a little bit later on in the book, I don't think he thought she was guilty of the crimes that she's eventually accused of, but I think he definitely believed that she had betrayed him in the worst possible way by not giving him what she had essentially promised.
Promised. Right, right. So you promised me a son, you didn't give it to me, therefore you're guilty of that kind of thing. So that was a great betrayal in his mind.
And probably the fact that when they're, you know, during that period where they're courting and they're talking about the future, you know, like any sort of new couple, they're working towards a shared goal. They're very united working towards that goal of annulment. They're both mm-hmm. interested in very similar things, although I think Anne was more reform-minded than Henry. But, mm-hmm. you know, they're working towards these shared goals. And I think it was a very positive time where they're probably thinking this reign is going to be amazing for the country. You know, they're going yes. to be able to... England is going to really stand out for this. And then what do we get? We get turmoil and trouble after trouble after trouble during right. Anne's reign. So I think on top of the fact that there was no son, which, yes. is a great betrayal in Henry's mind, the idea that he had in his head of what their reign would look like turned out nothing like what it actually looked like. And right. Henry doesn't cope well with those changes to what he's imagining and what is actually happening to him in front of him. He actually, that is when things turn deadly, to be honest.
Yes, yes. And so, and that's an interesting way to sort of, with that in the background, think about why in March and into April, he was still insisting she be recognized as queen, because that's what he said. However he felt about her, if he says she's queen, then everyone needs to recognize her as queen until she's not. So it does get confusing, because you think, oh, is he still committed to the marriage? Yeah. And it's more that he's committed to being right.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Henry is incapable of admitting to mistakes. Absolutely incapable. He never does. If anyone can give me an example throughout his reign where he's actually said, oh, actually, I was wrong. You're right. You know, I'd love to hear it, because the man just cannot admit to mistakes. It is always somebody else's fault. And usually, and I think it's why the poet Thomas White obviously wrote about thunder around the throne, he looks to the people closest to him.
And we see this time and time again.
Mm-hmm. You know, and while Catherine was alive, it was Catherine's fault. You know, everything was Catherine's fault. The minute she dies, he needs someone else to blame. And Anne is the perfect scapegoat. She's, you know,
right.
She's close to him. She's just somebody that he can very easily lay all his troubles on and lay the blame on. So, yeah, and it's difficult, because I think Henry always wants to come out looking good. He wants to look like he is the chivalric knight, you know, and this great Renaissance prince. He doesn't want people thinking he's awful or is a murderer or whatever. So he does things in, they're very sort of interesting ways. So I think he's always got this facade up, but he's always working in the background to whatever his ultimate goal is. And I think his ultimate goal was to rid himself of Anne, but he wanted to find a way that wasn't going to make him look like he'd made a mistake. But if he tried to annul the marriage, which is what I suppose most people would expect, you know, find some reason to have that marriage annulled, it's basically like saying, oh, actually, Catherine of Aragon, the Pope, Charles V, you were all right. I shouldn't have married her. It was a mistake. It's caused me a lot of issues. He's never, ever going to say that. So he's waiting. He's looking for an opportunity that allows him to, you know, extricate himself from this marriage without looking like he'd made a mistake. And Cromwell, of course, is there to serve the king in any capacity, and is the one, I think, that plants the seed of a more permanent removal for Anne.
Right. So let's move into Cromwell's role, because he seems to be waiting for, you know, waiting. It seems like at some point, Anne and Cromwell, it's one or the other. They're not going to both be able to remain at the king's side. And Cromwell decides, I think, pretty clearly that he's going to be the one to stay. So, and you see him doing things like, just little things you can miss, like he gives his rooms to Edward Seymour, Jane Seymour's brother, so that she will be right next to the king. You know, he just makes it, he's very clearly promoting the Seymours. And then he doesn't himself overhear, I don't think, but it's reported to him, this conversation between Anne and Henry Norris, that seems to really tip things into motion. So can you talk to us about that? Because it seems like courtly love gone wrong. It seems like Anne spoke foolishly, which is surprising for her, but you can understand what desperate straits she was in and how much pressure she was under, and sort of took courtly love too far. And yet it had such deathly consequences, based on that treason law you mentioned earlier. So can you sort of wrap all that? It's a very complicated picture, but yes.
Trying to think
bring all those strings together.
Yeah, I also think that this idea that Anne and Cromwell were allies, and you know what, I really wish they had been, because I think this story could have ended quite differently had they been. However, I don't think they were ever allies. Unlike someone like Thomas Cranmer that did in fact owe his rise to the Boleyns, Thomas Cromwell did not. He was Wolsey's man. He, in fact, even incorporated elements of his heraldry into his own insignia. Like, you know, this was a very public display of his loyalty to Thomas Wolsey. It was Wolsey and Wolsey's associates that you know, paved Cromwell's way at court. And then, of course, he catches Henry's eye because the man is a genius. Cromwell is a genius.
Yes.
There is no other way of sort of describing him. You can like him, you can hate him, but you can't disagree with the fact that this is a highly intelligent man,
and
you
know, unbelievably hardworking.
And so hardworking. Henry never found a man like him ever again. He looked and he looked and he looked. There was no one like him. And I think, although he never admits it, I don't think publicly, but I think he did regret the loss of Thomas Cromwell, who worked like five men, basically. So unfortunately, I don't think he, you know, I think there was a a relationship, a working relationship between Cromwell and Anne, while Henry wanted them both and while Cromwell mm-hmm. knew that Henry wanted them both. I think the moment, and it's his job, Cromwell's job as the king's right-hand man to know what Henry wants, even perhaps without Henry saying anything, you know, just hinting mm-hmm. at things to know the king's will. He writes that over and over again in his little notes that he keeps, his little like to-do list, to know the king's will on this matter or to know the king's will on, you know. So that is his job. That's what he's brilliant at. So he knows what Henry wants. And mm-hmm. he's looking for a way to get his master out of this without making him look bad.
Right.
And I think there are some sort of important moments in the Anne Cromwell story. And one of them is a sermon that's a very controversial yes. sermon. That's
yes.
given at the start of April by John Skipps, or Anne's almoner. And it's a bit of a, you know, it's not all clear cut because there are several drafts of this sermon that survive. And so it's possible that the one that we focus on perhaps was not the one delivered. There's all mm-hmm. these sorts of questions that we need to acknowledge. But however, I think it is in keeping firstly with Anne's character, with what we know yes. of her personality, and it does seem to fit the story. So yes. basically in this sermon given by Anne's almoner in front of King and Court and Cromwell and everyone, her John Skip makes comparisons, shall we say, between Thomas Cromwell and the biblical traitor Haman or Haman. So this is an incredible attack on Cromwell. Basically, yes. you know, just very quickly, it's the story of Esther and King Ahasuerus. So basically, this wicked minister has tricked the king into hoping to have the king execute all his Jewish subjects, and he even offers him money in order to do it. And in the end, the very good queen, the wise queen Esther, steps in and kind of, you know, makes the king see reason, and then mm-hmm. Haman is executed for his treason.
Right.
So this is the story that is brought before King and Court, and everyone knows exactly what's going on here. You know, the right. good king is, of course, Henry. Mm-hmm. You know, the wicked minister is Cromwell. Mm-hmm. The poor Jewish people are the clergy, and this massacre is the destruction of the monasteries. Mm-hmm. This is what's been commented on. And the fact that, you know, Haman is executed in this story.
Yes.
This is powerful stuff. This is basically a death threat. This is Anne saying that she's bringing this to Cromwell. That's it. That this is, it's all on after this. And I think, you know, I think this is when this idea about a more permanent removal comes into play. And there's yes. another very important event which takes place only a couple of weeks after, when Eustace Chapuis actually visits Court. I think it's the 18th of April.
Yeah.
And things go not the way Cromwell wants them. He, in fact, is basically given a very public and embarrassing dressing down by Henry in front of, like, Seymour brothers and all other people. Negotiations that he's been dealing with Chapuis for an imperial alliance for months and months, that the king has known for and has been completely aware of.
Where,
he kind
right.
of turns his back on and just sort of says, I have no idea what you're talking about, you know, and makes all these ridiculous demands of Charles V, which, you know, everyone knows he's not going to do. So Cromwell leaves Court that day and he's absolutely shaking. He goes back to his home and he speaks to Chapuis, and he basically has lost. I think what happened to Cromwell that day is that he realized he couldn't rely on Henry to protect him against Anne, you know, that he's too mm-hmm. fickle. Like, he realizes mm-hmm. that Henry's promises are probably worth not very much. So there's, again, a shift. And then the traditional tale is that he gets very sick and he retreats to his home in order to recover. But in fact, what it does appear that he's doing is planning the details
of
how he's going to get rid of Anne. However, with Henry's permission. I have to just add that because I think that's important.
Right, 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 right. So he's going in looking for reasons, and Anne has this conversation with Norris where she imagines the king's death. If aught but good were to happen to the king, you would look to have me, kind of thing. Not really in any way, shape, or form plotting the king's death, but speaking it. And that alone gives Cromwell some ammunition to move forward in a new way. And is that what creates the image of Anne holding Elizabeth and pleading with the king? That is it, Aless that writes to Elizabeth about later that he had seen this scene. And at that point, Anne is begging the king, holding Elizabeth And Elizabeth hears about this later. That's the scene, right?
That is the scene, but it's difficult to sort of know because Anne reveals this story about Norris and mm-hmm. I think also about Weston, if I'm correct, mm-hmm. while she's in the tower. So she's already been arrested. So this is sort of, you know, she's arrested on the 2nd of May.
Right.
So what ammunition they had on her prior to that appears to be just an incident that occurred with Mark Smeaton, where okay. he was kind of, you know, in her rooms and she said, oh, what are you doing in here? You know, what's wrong with you type thing? And kind of told him off and said, you know, don't presume that I will speak to you like I speak to the other gentleman. And he just seemed to be kind of lovesick around her. I think it's right. that story that was carried, you know, to Cromwell and to Henry, because
okay.
I think that Mark Smeaton was the first one arrested on the 30th of April.
Okay.
So I think he was already under arrest and had been questioned by Thomas Cromwell himself by the time of the May Day joust, which is the 1st of May, and Anne is then arrested on the 2nd of May, and then things obviously escalate from there because she basically hands them more ammunition on a platter because she's so, of course, stressed and under
right.
extreme pressure and having something of a nervous breakdown, of course, as you can imagine.
Right.
So it's difficult. There are contradictory reports, so it's hard to piece together the timeline perfectly, but it right. does appear they had something, but not anything really catastrophic, because even on the 27th of April, they're questioning the Bishop of London, asking him, could Henry abandon Anne? Like, how could he do that? So it's quite clear they don't have anything. They've only got okay. little rumors of, you know, mm-hmm. good times in the Queen's Chamber type thing, but they don't have anything substantial. It's only the incident with Smeaton. And I think once she's in the tower that she starts unraveling
yeah.
and talking and blabbing, and they're encouraging the ladies that are waiting on her, are encouraging her to talk, and mm-hmm. she incriminates herself. It's really quite awful and tragic. I think
yes.
also it appears that when Mark Smeaton was arrested, let's remember he's not like the others. He's not a gentleman. He's not a right. member of the Amber. He's not a friend of the king's from a long time, although he was a favorite, a really great favorite of the king's. And the questioning, there's been questions raised about how physical this questioning got, but mm-hmm. it would have been terrifying either way. If you suddenly find yourself in front of Thomas Cromwell, who is asking you all these questions about your involvement with the queen, and you are in your, you know, he may have been 24, 25.
Right.
Now, at the time, he doesn't have the experience that Sir Henry Norris has. He
no,
doesn't have the
no.
experience that the other men have. And
right.
he is facing the full horrors of a traitor's death, hanging, drawing.
Right. And,
whereas, you know, then they've got this leverage on him where, look, just confess and we'll make this just a simple beheading or whatever they said to him. So
right.
he's the only one that confesses to having had sort of carnal knowledge of the queen, as they call it.
Right, right. And it's so interesting that the moment when, you know, Henry and Anne on May Day sitting together and then he leaves. So it's at the joust, which is reminds us of the jousting jealousy you mentioned earlier. So he can no longer joust. And if he was preparing for that May Day joust, there it is. And he's not participating. And these other men are participating. And it just unravels so quickly from then on. But the fact that it happened at a joust and that's when he walks away from Anne and never sees her again is really haunting, given his accident and given that sense of himself that he had. So
when I came to this, I felt like, you know, those moments where you feel like something is going on here, you know,
mm-hmm.
I really do believe that this was perfectly curated by Henry. He mm-hmm. had planned this to make this his exit. This was going to be his stage. He's a performer. He doesn't do things quietly. He's
no.
never, you know, exited a room quietly or entered a room quietly.
Right.
This is a big moment, and he's going to show his subjects that even though he's not jousting, he's not participating in the joust, and what a coincidence that every man that watched him fall is in the joust, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's going to allow them this sort of triumphant moment one more time. He's put them up on a pedestal only so that fall is going to be harder.
That's
that
right.
is really what I think the evidence shows, that he is showing everyone that he has every single person in the palm of his hand, and he can raise
yes.
you, but he can also crush you, you know, within a moment. And I think this is perfectly planned. This is what he wants. He wants to exit at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to raise them one more time, just so that fall that they're all about to fall dramatically is going to be
right.
all the more painful and all the more dramatic, and send a very, very clear message to to his subjects, and that is that he is still very much in charge.
That's right. And within just those 19 days, these men who were sort of stars in a way, a little way in that joust, were gone. You know, this queen he had moved heaven and earth for, gone. You know, there is no greater way to show that power of his than to be so public about it and have everyone watch him stand up and walk out of that joust. And without him, all those people crumbled. So because of him, right? So
yes, yeah,
very, very interesting. So let's just mention the swordsman that he orders, because I think that is another thing I hear people debate about. I've heard it put down to the king was generous in the end. I have a lot of trouble believing it came from generosity.
Sorry that I laughed.
Yes, I know. Ugh. But I mean, you mentioned that some of the people who saw her execution may have seen, and in your words, the bloodbath of the day before. And I think that's it. I think he didn't want any kind of botched execution. This was the first queen to be executed. It had to be elegant in a way. I mean, it had to be perfect. There was no room for error. And I think that's why he wanted the swordsman. So tell me what you think, because it just seems to me he was orchestrating it. It was a show to him in many, many ways.
Again, he orchestrated every single detail of Anne's execution and of the execution of the men who were sadly and tragically executed alongside her, which would have been an incredible bloodbath. Anne was given the privilege, if you can call it that, of a private execution, which means it took place within the precincts of the Tower, whereas the other men were all executed on Tower Hill, so very public, thousands of people, and it must have been absolutely horrific, especially for Mark Smeaton, which being the one of the lower status, was the last to be executed. So George Boleyn first, because he's obviously higher status, brother of the Queen, Mark Smeaton last. So if you can just for a moment imagine the sight that must have been in front of him when it was his turn to put his head on the block. They were executed by an axe, with an axe, I should say. This is never a good way to go. Even for a very skilled axeman, it takes several blows and, in fact, usually requires the executioner to pull a knife out at the end to do the sort of finish the job. You know, this is horrific, horrific stuff that happened to, as you say, these stars of court. They were like the superstars, you know, the rock stars. And that was just so tragic and awful. Anne is then granted. So I think it's on the day that the men are executed, so the 17th of May, that Henry issues a writ from Westminster, parliamentary writ, to Sir William Kingston, saying that because he's been moved, you know, by pity for his wife, for his former wife, you know, he's going to commute the sentence because she could have been burned. Mm-hmm. You know, that was when her uncle pronounced the punishment at court. He said that she could be burned or beheaded at the king's will. So Henry says, moved by pity, he's going to allow her to be beheaded. And yes, he selects a swordsman from Calais to come to do the job, apparently very skilled. So William Kingston said something along the lines of, oh, yes, he can handle the job. So he felt quite confident that this man was going to do, you know, a good job with this. It was much cleaner, swifter in terms of executions. We do know that it took just one stroke to behead her. But was it genuine pity that moved Henry? This is the question, and it's such an interesting question. Again, Sarah Griswood, I think it's in her book Tudors in Love, has some very interesting ideas about this. She feels that it's because the sword was the symbol of the chivalric code, this first joined Henry and Anne, and then it separated them. So he's sort of aligning himself with this because he always wants to align himself with the chivalric code.
Right, yes, yes. That's the thing to do.
There's something like he morphed from Lancelot, the wooer to Arthur, the wounded, or something along those lines. So she draws some really interesting conclusions there about the sword and its symbol of the chivalric code. And I think that has something to do with it, because I think Henry always wants to come out looking the best, you know.
Right.
He wants to come out in the best possible light, and he wants to be seen. He's the way they've created this case and the way they've done this, he and Cromwell, is for him to look like he's been wronged. He hasn't made a mistake. No, he didn't make a mistake marrying Anne. She turned into this lustful, crazy, you know, sex addict and wanted all the men at court. and wanted to kill him and all this sort of stuff. Henry hadn't made a mistake. It was Anne that
changed. No, of course not.
So Henry's been wronged, yet he's a merciful prince. So he's going to allow her this sort of swifter end, connected to these ideas of chivalry, which is what he wants to align himself with. I don't think it was real pity that moved him whatsoever. I think it was, again, him curating everything to make himself look in the best possible light so that people, when they talk about this event, are not going to say, oh, that terrible Henry. They're going to say, oh, how merciful he was. Wonderful. And some people have said it. So, he, you know, it partly worked.
Kind of amazing when you think, oh, that's mercy.
Yeah.
So through this marvelous story, we end up with this woman who has been so brave and so intelligent and bold, died boldly is how it was reported abroad, and has captured our imagination and just held it. You know, the last time I was at Hever Castle, I was in upstairs in the Great Hall, and I'd been speaking with the guard, and then he was speaking with some other people, and he mentioned, you know, some of the people who come here, Anne Boleyn Nutters, and I just raised my hand. Yeah, that would be me, you know, absolutely 100%. But we just can't let go of her, right? I mean, she just so continues to fascinate us. And one of the things I thought was so interesting when the now Prince and Princess of Wales, then Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, had their first child, the headline was, "Take that, Anne Boleyn. It's a boy." It wasn't "Take that, Catherine of Aragon," or anybody else. It's Anne Boleyn, you know? So I think she continues. So what do you think it is about her that just captures our attention so strongly and won't let go?
It's a huge question. You'd think I'd have a very well-rehearsed answer to this right now, but I actually don't, because my thoughts sort of keep evolving on it, and I like to kind of think about it on the spot. I think there's a few different reasons why she still captures our attention the way she does. I think one of those reasons is that it is just an extraordinary story, you know, full stop. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we make sense of our lives through story, through telling stories. And I think this story is really unbelievable. If you didn't have the sources to kind of confirm that it in fact happened, you'd be questioning whether this is a complete fictional account, because it is an extraordinary story. It's perhaps not the rise, you know, the rags to riches story that has been painted, because Anne was certainly never in rags. However, it's still a meteoric rise to power. Mm-hmm. It's still got every element of, you know, all the soaps that we love to watch and all that sort of thing. It is just a captivating story. And I think the contrast between the 7 years of battling to marry her and then having her executed after, you know, not even three years, is quite, there's something a little bit macabre that people love about that. It's that, you know, there's that element that I just think the story is incredible. But I think there's also this element of kind of mystery. There's so much about Anne that we don't know. You know, even when was she born? We can have a debate just about that. You know, how did she spend her time in France? What's the evidence to suggest she was in France? We know she was there, but, you know, all these things. How did she, you know, what were her 3 years serving Catherine of Aragon like? What was their relationship, right? There's so much that we don't know. So I think this element of the unknown and mystery keeps us kind of going back to see if we can solve it. And then I think, because of the fact that there's so much we don't know, she is very much open to interpretation.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that she is open to interpretation means that people connect with her on lots of different levels. You know, I think it's hard to sort of pinpoint why you have an affinity with a person. Even now, you might meet someone and feel like you're very connected to them. I think it's the same with historical characters. Sometimes you come across someone and you just feel an affinity with them, which I think happens a lot with Anne, because people connect to different parts of her story. Some people like, you know, and she's been obviously labeled so many times, and she's been reassessed, and she's been kind of recreated by every century and every generation. Mm-hmm. So some people like the fact that she's a bit of a seductress. Others really enjoy the fact that she's a bit like a feminist, or, you know, maybe a bit of one. So we're connecting on all different levels with her. And I think that's what makes her so kind of far reaching. And you're right, there's just an insatiable appetite for Anne and all things Anne Boleyn. And I'm delighted by that.
Right. Well, fortunately for us, you continue to explore and then to share all of your research. So thank you again. Now, can you tell us what you're working on now and how we can follow you. And of course, I'll put all these links in the show notes.
Oh, of course. Thank you. If you're not tired of hearing me talk about Anne Boleyn yet, I do have my own podcast. So Talking
Yes,
Tudor,
yes.
Which, you know, everyone is welcome to come and listen to, not just about Anne, it's about the whole Tudor period. And there's almost 200 episodes there, free episodes for everyone to enjoy.
And so they're wonderful. So yes, absolutely.
Very, very busy, of course. I'm also this year, very exciting, the first year that I put on a year-long course. So it's called 365 Days with Anne Boleyn. So we're about a third of the way through that with a wonderful group of people. And we're just doing a very deep dive into Anne's life, literally lasting the whole year. So
wonderful.
And so that is probably my other main job at the moment, working on that. I have some other ideas for some future projects, which I can't quite reveal just yet, but I'm always looking to obviously expand my knowledge of Anne and the Tudor period and make, you know, the most sort of give the most up-to-date information coming out of the kind of academic world in a way that we can all access and enjoy. Right. I'm very passionate about bringing history to everybody, regardless of what you do, of your level of education. I think it's important that we all have access to these wonderful sources and to as accurate information as we can. It's, you know, a lot of it is debatable, but that is definitely my passion of bringing communities together. And it's why, you know, I have several social media accounts. So yeah, social media, basically the usual Twitter, Instagram, which I quite like Instagram. It's probably my favorite at the moment. So you'll find me quite active there. It's the most happy 78. Talking Tudors is also on Instagram, and then there's Facebook, of course. So I'm kind of everywhere. So yeah, so you'll just, if you do a bit of a Google, you'll find, but I'll send you some links.
Yes, and I will have those. So, and please do follow Natalie and all that she's doing, because it is always a treat. I love reading and then listening, and so it's great. And these books she's got, and especially this side, the new one on Anne Boleyn, I was so excited. I've been waiting and waiting, so I was so excited. To get it. And I cannot thank you enough. I've been looking forward to this for so long. So thank you. And I know, and I just want to thank you also. You had a wonderful trip to the UK not long ago. And thank you for sharing so many pictures and videos of your trip, because I could almost feel like I was there with you. So
you're very welcome. Thank you for following along. Yeah, I do love, you know, sharing photos, because I know some people are not able to be there at the moment. And it's nice, I think, to be able just to see some little videos and see the things that we're talking about. I've also just joined recently TikTok, everyone. So if you are a TikToker and you'd like to, I've been posting, lots of little videos on there. And sometimes I try not to post the same content that I post on Insta all the time. Okay. So, you know, worth jumping on there if you're on there. It's a bit of fun. It's a whole different world. I think I'm a bit too old for it, but it's fine.
Well, so that's good. That's good you told me, because I've not yet taken that foray into TikTok, but
I think it's a bit of fun, and I know it's a great way of connecting with the younger generations who are loving the Tudors, and it's and there's a lot of the well-known and the favorite Tudor historians on there, so it's fun.
All right, well, I'll have that link as well for you, but thank you so much on behalf of all of us, and especially thank you for me. This has been such a delight, and I will, again, I'll have all those links. If you don't have the book yet, everyone, just what are you waiting for? Get it now and listen to Natalie on the podcast and all the social media. It's just always a delight. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. I do have a favor. If you enjoyed this episode, could you please go leave a rating, maybe refer to a friend, and think about joining our patron family. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll keep shaking up history together.